This is the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show number 70. You're listening to the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com and email us on mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe in the UK.
Now I'm Kevin Sampath in Australia. Coming up on the show, we have a chat with Pitch Vision's batting coach, Gary Pump. And we also have our second part of the interview with Dr. Will James, the lead psychologist with the ECB. And David, I'm sure you have a useful fact for us for the number 70.
Useful, no, but it's a fact. 70 is the second lowest ever 2020 international score, scored by Bermuda against Canada in 2008 in the qualifiers that Afghanistan have been doing so well in recently. But in the 2008 version of that, Bermuda managed a poor 70 against Canada. So I don't know about you, but I'm sure you've played in some games where you've been rolled over like that, and it's never a nice experience.
Yeah.
And it's also the number of scores the number of times Sachin Tendulkar has scored 50 or more in one day international cricket, which is pretty impressive, isn't it? 70 times, yeah. He's gone over the 50 mark, and he's converted 21 of those into centuries, and that was pretty good. 21 won the international centuries. I'd be happy with that.
Yes.
And in that time, he's managed to hit over 1,000 boundaries. So wow. That's when you look at numbers like that, you realise what a good player he really is.
Yeah, 1,000 boundaries is something for our 1,000th show, David.
Yeah, sometime in the distant future. So let's take things back down to more human levels rather than the superhuman Sachin Tendulkar. How did you get on at the weekend?
Well, David, I don't know if I've ever said this before this year, but we actually dominated this game. We were playing the team coming last, so we did dominate. We got them all out for 90. They won the toss and they batted first.
Ah, okay. A bit like Bermuda.
Yeah, 90 on a home ground is pretty substandard. I mean, the average is about 150 to 180.
Yeah.
And at stumps, we were 180 for 8, having a second day still to bat. So we're going to try and win this game outright to give us the best possible chance to make the finals, which at the moment seems a bit distant.
So it's still mathematically possible that you can make it into the top four?
Yeah, we need the teams who won from the first half of the season to win again. But now there's a lot of other teams that are in form as well, so it's going to be really hard for us.
So it's quite a tight league then. There's not much in it between all the sides.
Yeah, the top three have sort of cemented their spots, so it's a battle for fourth place between three teams. So it's interesting, but it's also good to play in because there's a lot of competition and every moment is sort of tense rather than just a team, a competition where there's a few easy beats and top four are usually really strong teams to beat.
And how have your team been reacting to pressure through the season? It's been a bit of an up and down year, hasn't it? So what would your analysis of dealing with pressure situations be for the team as a whole?
Yeah, Dave, when I think back to the games we've had sort of pressure situations, I think most of the games we've been able to come out of the pressure situations victorious. If there's been a close game, we'd be able to hold our heads in. And I think that's mainly due to the experienced players in our team. Mm. But the games where we have lost is where we actually totally lost from the start. So we either, right. If we start well, we usually finish off well. But when we start badly, that's when we tend to lose games. So that's probably our focus for next season and a learning point from this year.
So kind of the first hour of the game almost is, you can pin it down to that kind of level of detail, do you think?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at this game, we got 3 wickets in the first hour, which sort of set the tone for the rest of the game. Whereas other games, when we're bowling or batting, we either lose 3 wickets or we don't get the first wicket for about an hour and a half. So it makes it really hard for the setting momentum and the tone for the rest of the game. And I know momentum is something we spoke about last week, but it really is really important for teams, especially if you're out there on the field, to keep you going.
Yeah, I do agree. Momentum can you can let momentum get the better of you, definitely.
Yeah.
But also, I think good teams also know how to turn momentum around as well, and even if things are going badly, find a way of getting back into the game. And maybe that's a skill you need to develop as a team, is finding a way to get back into the game when you start badly.
Yeah, and that also comes down to experience, David, because we have a lot of younger guys in our team and they don't know how to react when momentum shifts and they sort of lose their head, either give up their wicket easily or start bowling astray, me included. When momentum shifts, I tend to bowl all over the place, or when I'm batting, I tend to lose my head. So I think it comes either with experience or you really have to train yourself really hard for that. And I'm sure this off-season coming up with something, we'll concentrate towards that, actually having match situations where we'll try to practice shifting our momentum, either by keeping our head in tense situations or batting well in tense situations.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even in the net, even going so far as if you're in the nets and you're just having a hit, you know, maybe you can. It was like Will James said last week, even if you're just having a hit in the nets, if you sort of quietly speak to the batsman and say, right, okay, this is the match situation here. You know, we've lost three quick wickets and you're coming in and the bowler's bowling really well. How do you play that situation? Even just doing that, and then the batsman has to work out how best to play that situation. It's not perfect because you're in the nets, but at least you're thinking about it and at least you're planning for that situation to happen. I think with a lot of people, they don't think about what to do when things are going wrong. They only think about what to do when things are going well. And they only plan for when things work and when everything goes well. But sometimes it's 200 for one and you're throwing the ball and there's no swing and there's a flat track and you think, what am I going to do now? But it's almost too late when you're standing at the top of your mark. But if you've got a plan that you thought about beforehand, then okay, even if it doesn't work, at least you've thought about it and at least you're trying something rather than just running up and hoping. But anyway, that's all irrelevant because you're doing well this week and you're going to go for an outright on win on Saturday.
Yep, fingers crossed.
We've got a bowling machine this year, so we've got have a nice practice with the bowling machine every week so far anyway, which is good because the big problem with nets, especially with club nets, is that you get maybe two-thirds of the balls are good practice and then probably another third are just complete rubbish, either from a not very good bowler who's bowling too slow or whatever, or a really bad bowler who just flings it into the side netting and you think, well, what was the point of that? So, and I, to be fair, I'm one of those bowlers who flings it into the side netting more often than not, so it's not fair on the bat. So I deliberately try and avoid bowling too much because I know that it's not very good practice for the guy at the other end. I mean, I'm okay, but you know, I bowl very, very slow, medium pace or off breaks, and neither of them are very accurate. So you know, what's the point? What's the point if you're bowling to a star batsman? He's going to smash you all around the park. He's not going to get any practice from it. You're not going to get any practice. So what I do is I slip my wicket keeping kit on as quick as I can and jump into one of the nets to try and avoid it. I can spend a good 20 minutes in the net avoiding bowling, but still also doing some wicket keeping practice. So that works out quite well. And then I'll have a few minutes on the bowling machine at the end.
Yeah.
Because you can't really expect people to bowl to you if you're not bowling to other people.
Yes.
Not that I want to avoid it. If I was a brilliant bowler, I'd bowl all the time. But I haven't even got potential as a bowler. So I'll avoid it. I'd much prefer facing the machine, although I probably will have to face a real bowler at some point. At least I know the machine roughly where the machine's going to bowl it. And then I can practice certain shots that I'm perhaps a little bit weaker on. And that's going quite well.
Well, we have again Pitch Vision's batting coach, Gary Palmer, and we're going to ask him a question again this week. Now, Gary is a first-class cricketer who played for Somerset, and he now helps young players in the game with CCM Academy. So if you want to find out more about Gary Palmer and his coaching, please visit www.pitchvision.com/Gary Palmer. Let's see how Gary answers this question this week.
Hi, Gary. Welcome to the show.
Hi, David.
This week, we've got a question from Brad, who's in Australia. And he's got a question about the pull shot.
All right.
He says it's one of his most prolific run-scoring shots, but it also gets him out a lot. He generally plays it from the first ball, and he doesn't want to give up the shot, but a lot of people have suggested that he should, or that he shouldn't play it until he's got a few runs on the board.
Yeah.
He says that seems wrong to him, because he doesn't play it any differently whether he's on 1 or 100. But the main problem is, when he gets it wrong, his back foot goes back instead of back and across, and then he gets cramped for room, and he pops the ball up to mid-wicket or somewhere around there. Is there anything he can do to improve playing the shot, or is it just a tactical thing that he should maybe cut it out for until he gets his eye in or something like that?
Well, if he's backing away, I would find it hard to believe that he is a consistently good hooker. Because if you back away against real pace, you get very sideways on, get blocked off, and you can't get good access to the ball. So maybe, and I could be totally wrong here because I don't know the standard he's playing at, but at the standard he's playing, it may allow him to get away with hooking the ball well because he's got a very good eye and hand-eye coordination. But as you get into better cricket, where people bowl quicker and tighter lengths and lines, if you're backing away, I think it's going to be very difficult to be consistent of being a good hooker. So maybe what this player should do, should first of all go away and work on always going across the crease to play the shot, because it's technically a more efficient way of doing it and it will be a lot easier. Master that with sort of hand feeds, tennis balls, then cricket balls, tennis racket feeds, and gradually build it up to either someone standing quite close throwing it short at you from the floor upwards, or one bounce, or against the machine, or against some bowlers. And then when he's mastered it, you know, if he has got good hand-eye coordination, I'd say to him, don't be afraid to play it, but obviously pick the type of wickets you play it on, because maybe he's trying to play the same shot to the same length of ball on all wickets. Some wickets are fast, some are slow. You know, maybe he wants to save this for the flat, quick tracks, rather than the wickets where it's stopping a little bit and the ball's deviating. Maybe he needs to think about picking which bowlers he's going to do it to. Maybe if they're really, really quick, when he first goes into bat, he might want to think, well, let's have a look at it first, duck and weave a few. And when I feel good that I could, you know, I'm feeling good, I'm going to play the shot, then do it. But I wouldn't stop playing it.
So rather than a question we had the other week where it was more a matter of not having the confidence, he's got the confidence to play the shot, but it's his technique's probably letting him down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting one, the pull shot, because when you see the way people tend to pull these days, they go back and across, mm-hmm. and they leave their left leg, if they're right-hander, up in the air and sort of paddle it round, square the wicket. I mean, Graham Thorpe was quite good at doing that. Alex Stewart used to do it. And it seems to be a way that's being coached. Now, I think that sort of hook shot, where you lift your leg up and just help it on its way, and sometimes they do it to a ball that's not actually that short, that is something which a player's developed themselves. They think that that's my own little shot. I know I can do it. I'm a good enough player. That's my thing. But I think we're not seeing enough of the old-fashioned, you know, West Indies of the 70s and 80s, who were all fantastic hookers. The likes of Viv Richards, Gordon Greenidge, Desmond Haynes, Khalid Charan. They would go back and across, open up, so they can really get a lot of the bat on the ball. They're hitting it more in front of square with the option of hitting behind square. And because they've opened up, they can get more power into it. They're more stable when they hit it. And for me, they're hitting the ball at arm's length, so they've got time. Whereas the way people do it nowadays, they go back and across, lift their left leg up, it's still out in front of them. The ball then gets to them quite quickly. They get cramped for room if they don't do it very well. And generally, the ball always goes behind square. But the old-fashioned way where they go across, open up, spin around on their leg, and they can get more power into it, I think we should be teaching that more than the other way. Because the other way is just a way that players have developed, you know, a method, an extra method, additional improvising way themselves. But that's not for, you know, across the board. That's not what we should all be doing. I think it's the old-fashioned way. Ala Viv Richards.
Would you say perhaps as well, maybe at lower levels, at sort of club level, the pull shot becomes a bit of a default shot to anything that's not pitched up, which is on leg stump or midland leg, where you could be playing perhaps a back foot on drive. It's just that the instinct kicks in and the bottom hand comes across and you swipe at it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, club players, if they could sort of play back foot on drives and defend it around that area, that would be a sign that they're pretty decent players technically. And if you can do those shots, then it's easier to play the hook shot. And, you know, when you're batting, you're taking less of a risk, aren't you? Because you only really hook the one or pull the one that's there to pull, whereas a lot of club players, the minute it's just down that line, they have a go pulling it anyway, and sometimes it's too full. But just going back to those two different body positions for pulling, the other thing with just lifting that front leg up is that you also look like you're closed off, as opposed to where you hit it and swivel around the old-fashioned way.
So the other thing you would say is perhaps work on judging the length early as well as the line to make sure that you're not just playing the shot based on line.
It's what their preconceived idea in their mind is, isn't it? If you go out to bat and you can't play a back foot defence on the middle of the leg stump or a back foot on drive, you go out there with a mindset that, OK, I'll do all the straight off and on drives and forward defence when it's pitched up. When it's short, yeah, I might be able to play a back foot off drive and a cut, but when it's at my body, and generally that's where players don't play it very well because the techniques aren't right, their mindset is, right, OK, I'm going to hook it. So it's a massive risk. And if they put players out there and they can't defend the back foot drive, well, what do you do next? You hook it anyway and get caught, or get in two minds and pop one up in the air, or get caught behind. But if you can go out with a mindset that, you know, I'm playing in the V, both front and back foot, especially through mid on, you know, you've got those, you know, you've got your survival kit going, haven't you? Back foot defence, back foot drives. And the more you survive and stay out there, when that one is pinged in a bit shorter, you'll pick it up and you'll play the hook shot. But you've got to play safe level that you can do first before you elaborate and open up. Whereas the other way of playing, it's going straight into, oh, I'm going to hook it. You know, might have only faced three balls. Don't know what the wicket's like, how quick the bowler is. You haven't got any other option. You haven't got the defence option. Have a look at it. Have a feel of it. What's it like? How quick is it? Is it steep bounce? Is it a slow tennis ball bounce? How fast is this bowler? It's all about taking in as much detail as you possibly can.
Thanks, Gary, for your time. If you want to find out more about Gary Palmer, please visit www.pitchvision.com/Gary Palmer. Well, we now have the second part of our interview with Dr. Will James, the lead psychologist for the ECB. Dr. James works with the players from the A group right through to the English cricket team, and he also works with a company called Lane 4 that helps businesses with leadership and teamwork. Let's have a listen in to the chat Dr. James had with David.
If you're a coach, you know, you're coaching maybe a club under 17 side or something like that, and you want to help players deal with pressure and all that side of things, you want to do those things in the nets. Can a coach who maybe hasn't got the formal qualifications do anything?
Yes, absolutely. I think we can spook this stuff up a bit too much, really. I think for years before the profession of sports psychology and performance psychology was almost invented, you know, there would have been examples of coaches, without realizing it, developing mental toughness in their performers. And whether that be by getting them to take responsibility and motivate themselves, you know, they rock up for a session, and rather than tell them what they're going to do, you ask them and you make sure they understand, whether it's by, you know, making them disciplined by having some really clear principles by which they, which you train, and having clear consequences if that those aren't achieved, whether it's by making the training really, really tough. You know, so it's, there's a real mixture, good level of challenge and support. Coaches are setting up scenarios, setting up sessions where the batsmen are facing bowlers off who are quicker than they might face in a match situation, or a bowling machine that's set up in a way that makes it tougher. So we're trying to get, you know, recognize here that over time, whether you've been a psychologist or whether you are a psychologist or not, you still have the ability to create a comfort zone or help players get out of their comfort zone. And what we're advocating here is if players get out of their comfort zone and in the right supportive environment, they will learn from that. They'll learn from making mistakes. They'll learn what they need to do. And you've only got to take your mind back to, you know, kids learning on the street. You know, that they're forever playing games and you know, trying stuff out and, you know, setting up challenging tasks and trying to find new ways of doing things. And I think if we're not careful as we progress as coaches and indeed as performance psychologists, we have to be very careful we don't get too much into tell mode, and we actually allow players to learn by making mistakes. And so by creating an environment that is tough, that is challenging, that sets some relevant targets, and then by helping the player to recognize what they did well and what they might do differently next time, and maybe with the use of things like role models. So who else do you know who does this really well? How do they approach it? I mean, how many times do we hear young kids saying, Beckham, this is like Beckham, or, you know, this is like Ponting, this is what Ponting would do. And kids do it at a young age, and we almost need to keep them doing that as they get older and older. And the under 17 age for me is a crucial age for keeping that experimentation, that learning really, really at an accelerated level.
With club and schools cricket, there's not much time for players to develop into a sort of well-run, smooth unit, if you like.
Yeah.
How can captains and the coaches of those teams build a good team in a short period?
Yeah, I mean it's a great question, and it's one that we get asked in sport all the time, and you know there are no easy answers. It's a bit like saying how can I recover more quickly from an injury. There's a certain amount of time that will always be needed. However, you know what we have to do is to look for the shortcuts and recognise perhaps. In looking for the shortcuts, it might be sometimes better to say, what is it that gets in the way of teamwork and teams performing well, and what I might call the interference in a team. And so I would normally classify that interference around three key areas. Firstly, is everyone really clear about what the team's trying to achieve, what its common purpose is, so what it's going to measure its performance by, what its ultimate ambition is, how it's going to go about that. The sort of tactics that are going to be used, the sort of roles that different people have to perform those, or to fulfil those performances. So really, really clarifying the sort of, you know, what is success for our team at different levels, both collectively, aspirationally, and then down at individual level. You know, what's my role within this team? Spending time communicating and clarifying that, and making sure people understand it, although it might seem time consuming, will save an awful lot of time down the line. The second area of interference often comes in terms of not really understanding how different people can get along, and understanding there are people will have different preferences and different personalities and different ambitions, motivations, and different skill sets. And so if the first piece was around making sure we're clear on the what, the next piece is clear on the who, and spending time really getting to know each other, and you know, what makes someone anxious, what makes someone confident, what do you need from each other. You know, if I'm going through a tough time, I don't really want lots of advice. What I want is to be, you know, to be left alone. Or if I'm going a bit quiet and almost into my shell, please feel free to give me a kick and chivvy me along. You know, and those sort of discussions about what I need, who I am, what switches me on, what switches me off, you know, is something that I appreciate. You know, in your sort of school age, might seem a bit adult, but actually, I think kids are ready to do that sort of discussing and just to learn, how do I help you if you're having a tough time? How do I help you perform at your best? And having those sort of discussions is crucial. And then the third area, if the first one is what and the second one is who, the third area is how, which is really just clarifying and picking off the last piece, really, which is how do we need to be as a team? How are we going to approach situations when we're winning? How are we going to approach situations when we're losing, you know, or in a bit of a rut? How are we going to turn a game around? What's our collective effort going to be like? How are we going to train and prepare? You know, so it's almost that sort of team charter, the team rules, and really coming to some clear identification of what those are. And obviously all those three areas, the what, the who, and the how, all interrelate. But I think if you can iron out and reduce as many interferences in those three areas as possible, then I think you maximize your opportunity to develop teamwork in a short space of time.
One of the difficulties with that kind of communication, especially if you're talking about at the amateur or recreational level, whatever you want to call it, is that people can be quite resistant to that kind of approach. You know, they don't want to sit down and talk about these things. They just want to turn up on Saturday afternoon, have their game of cricket, and then go away again. Although they're serious when they cross the boundary line, it becomes less serious when before the game starts or when the game is done. So are there informal ways that captains and coaches can go about establishing that?
Absolutely. I think you know, whilst I advocate that the team should do, you know, a lot of activities together, I think that's not the only way. And the other way would be that the coach and the captain do a lot of individual discussions, understanding and working out what individuals want and what they need and what they see as the key goals and the key issues in the team, in order that they can then prepare their own message back to the group as a whole. So if it is then having had some phone calls and having sat down with individuals in the bar, around training, on the phone, whenever it might be, they can then come to the start of the season or before different matches and start and remind people, you know, why are we here? How do we like to behave? How do we want to go about this? What do different people need? And really, you know, almost communicate that in a sort of pre-match, simple pre-match communication to the team and clarify expectations. I think the other thing they can do, coaches and captains, is set up, as we said before, set up training sessions that are very real. So get batsmen working together in the nets and get them talking to each other about how it's going. If they're playing out a real life scenario, what different things they like, what don't they like, you know, and actually reflecting on performance. And if even if it's relatively informal after a match, you know, the time spent around the bar, making sure conversations are getting under the skin a bit around, okay, so how was that? What did we do well today? Making sure that the team doesn't beat itself up all the time on what it's not doing well. It recognises the things it has done well. And even if it's one, making sure that the team realises, you know, the three or four things that have helped the team to win that can be repeated next week.
Thank you, Dr. James, for your time. You can get more information, tips, advice and tricks on our website at www.pitchvision.com. The site is updated daily and includes forums to chat with other cricketers around the world. If you were looking for questions this week, don't worry, we can still have it next week. So please email us your questions at mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. That's mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. You can also subscribe to the My Cricket Coach Show for free on iTunes. Or you can click the link on the show's page that will take you directly to iTunes to subscribe. Stay tuned for our next show on the 5th of March. So thanks for listening and I hope to see you next time. So from Sydney, Australia, this is Kevin Sandbach signing off.
And this is David Hinchcliffe in the UK.